Well, good afternoon, everyone. The meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. Well, members, there's been a lot of water over the dam since this committee met last time, but we traditionally do meet after each of the budget forecasts are released, both in November and in February. And I remember that 4 years ago, outgoing Ways and Means Chairman Dave Bishop had a meeting on this same day to look at the November forecast 4 years ago. So I thought that it was entirely appropriate that we have one today. I do want to offer my congratulations to all those members who did win, my condolences to those who did not, congratulations to others who are moving into different positions within their different caucuses, and I'll have a few other final remarks when we finish things up. But our main purpose today, of course, is to hear about the budget forecast, and we have some visitors who are not unfamiliar to our committee here. I want to welcome back Commissioner Ingerson, Mr. Shoewalter, and our economist, Dr. Tom Stinson. Welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Which of you would like to go first?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll get started here and just give a little. You should have a packet that includes a set of charts in a packet, as well as our striped document. That's a summary of the forecasters. A much more detailed version on our website, and I'd actually encourage you to read some things there about particular areas that you might be interested in. Mr. Chair and members, we'll try to maybe go through the packet of charts quickly so that we can get to some of your questions since the news came out a couple of days ago. I'm assuming there might be some particular things that you have interest in. But the chart on the bottom of your first page that's shown up here is actually a summary of the overview of this current biennium, and this shows that we have a surplus forecast for the current biennium 2006-2007 of just over $1 billion, and much of this was actually reported earlier in both our July economic update, where we talked about increased revenues over what was expected in final tax year 2005, and also in our October quarterly update, we reported an increase in revenues over forecast. And Tom Stinson will talk a little bit more in a couple more slides about the makeup of those revenues. But as you can see from this chart, it largely is a change in the revenues. There's a very slight change on the spending side. But overall, and Mr. Chair and members, I would never suggest to anyone that $1 billion isn't a lot of money, but when we look at the percentage changes on these revenue and spending numbers, they're actually quite small. It's less than 3% of a change in the revenues and less than 0.5% change in spending. And you'll see that the changes in the forecast are even more modest in the 2008-2009 biennium. And then I should just mention that the current law requires that we designate this surplus in fiscal at the end of this 06-07 biennium as available for rebate. So if you look at the chart on the top of page 2, this is a picture of the budget outlook for 2008-2009. This is our forecast that, again, this is a much more refined number from the planning estimates that we were using for this time period last year when we ended the legislative session. But this will, again, be the basis, this forecast and this information will be the basis on which we present the governor's budget recommendations next January. But there's a number of things that I'd like to talk to you about and explain in this chart. And first of all, in the far right column, you can see the change from the end of session in the beginning balance of $1 billion. That's that $1 billion surplus from this current biennium 2006-2007 carried into the next biennium. But then as we look at 2008-2009 and looking at that first column, the end of session, you'll see on the bottom there was a projected balance of $737 million. This is actually the amount that we anticipated would be the balance in 2008-2009 when we left the legislative session this last spring. And so what you're seeing then is the new numbers forecast, and then again moving to that far right column, a change in the revenue forecast increased over what we expected in those planning estimates of $297 million. And again, I'll just mention that that's less than 1%. So these changes are very modest in this, from the planning estimates to now our refined forecast. And then on the spending side, you'll see there's about $97 million less than what we expected, and that's 0.3%. So overall, the revenue and spending changes are slightly more than 1% of the budget period. And what this tells us is that our planning estimates from this last, as we used in the end of session, have largely held up, even as we're looking at, and Tom Simpson will talk a little bit more about the fairly modest changes on the economic side of the picture. And then just the chart on the bottom of page 2 is just another way to look at this. And overall, you're seeing that with the two bienniums, 06, 07, both the revenue change in that dark line, the spending change in the lighter line, showing a total of $1,038 million, and then for the upcoming biennium, that balance that was left here at the end of the legislative session at $737 million, and then the revenue change and spending change. So overall, this $2.1 $7 billion, and there's about $1.4 billion of that is actually changes that we're reporting to in this forecast. So a total of $2.17 billion available in the balance. At this point, I'd like to, turning to the top of page 3, turn things over to Tom Simpson to talk a little bit more about the components of the revenue changes.
Well, before I recognize Dr. Stinson, let me announce that we do have a quorum. Thank you for those who are here. Good to see all of you again, so I'll officially convene the meeting. Dr. Stinson.
As the commissioner indicated, the revenues are up for this biennium. They're up $913 million in 2006-2007. That's about 2.9%. For 2008-2009, they aren't up as much. They're only up $297 million, about 0.9%. The two big sources of the revenue increase, the income tax and the corporate income tax, they account for more than all of the total increase, actually. The individual income tax is up largely because final payments for tax year 2005 paid in on April 15th and refunds paid out for the 2005 tax year combined to increase the liability that we saw on that higher base liability then carries forward into 2006, 2007, 2008, and 2009. The growth in 2008, 2009 is a little bit less than the growth was in 2006, 2007 because projected growth in the tax base is a little bit less than we had before, but really it's almost all of this change in the forecast is due to higher tax year 2005 liability. On the corporate income tax, we have $330 million and $305 million of additional revenue in 06-07 and 08-09. That's really a huge increase from the forecast, 18% for 2006-2007 and 17.4% for 2008-2009. Corporate profits have just been much stronger than anybody expected, than we expected, or than Global Insight expected. In addition, the corporate income tax receipts, projected corporate income tax receipts have been increased because of a restatement of the cost of the Hutchinson technology decision. the new estimates provided by the Department of Revenue for the Hutchinson Technology decision reduced the cost of the state by $100 million in 2006-2007 on the tax side and $66 million in 2008-2009 on the tax side. It also reduced the spending for interest and penalty from the interest and penalty side that's on the expenditure side. So there's a total of $220 million of reduction in the cost of the Hutchinson Technology decision. We're concerned about the corporate taxes staying up. They're at an all-time high with they are at almost an all-time high with respect to their ratio to GDP. In the post-war period, they exceeded the current level only in the fourth quarter of 1950, right at the start of the Korean War. The sales tax is down $92 million and $154 million. That's due in part to weaker sales growth than we had in the forecast. That lower base carries forward, but it's also due in part to a reassessment of the costs or the benefits of the streamlined sales tax initiative. We took $36 million out because the money just doesn't seem to be showing up from the streamlined sales tax initiative for fiscal years 06 and 07. We took another $99 million out for fiscal year 08 and 09. Motor vehicle tax for 06-07 is also down slightly. It just reflects weaker than expected automobile sales. For 2008-2009, it's down almost 40%, and that's not weaker automobile sales. Most of that, $156 million of it, is due to the transfer of motor vehicle sales tax in the general fund into transportation funds. But even with that transfer, the lower sales reduced the total tax take by $50 million in addition to that $156 million. If you turn to the economy, our outlook for the economy really hasn't changed very much. The slide at the bottom of page 3 shows what's happened to the estimate for real gross domestic product. That hasn't changed very much at all. Fiscal year 07 is now weaker, but you can see that fiscal year 08 and fiscal year 09 are roughly the same. And one of the things that's happened is that unlike what usually happens when we have a weaker economy, we also have weaker estimates of inflation. The outlook for inflation has actually gone up. And if you look at the top of page 4, the graph at the top of page 4, you see nominal GDP. And there, it's really hard to see any difference in what's gone on. And if you look at the actual levels of nominal GDP at the end of the 2009 fiscal year, you'll see that they're almost identical. Sometimes in the past we've done line graphs and told you to look at the gap between the line, and that was an indication of the amount of revenue we were adding or the amount of revenue we were subtracting. Here the line graphs turn out to be it's impossible to see any change in there. Minnesota's economy has been strong. We've added a lot of jobs since the start of the year. We've caught up with the national economy, and we're proceeding at roughly the same pace as the national economy in terms of employment at this point. We think that the strong job growth that we've seen over the last 6 months is going to come to an end right now, and that over the next year we'll only see about 20,000 jobs increase in the state. That's compared to the 54,000 that we've seen through October, from January through October. So employment growth is going to be a little bit weaker in Minnesota than we had before. Our real concern is housing.
Excuse me, can I interrupt you? I've got a question from Representative Dempsey.
I guess I need your point of view. Go back to page 3 again, and here we've got individual income is less in 2008 and 2009. It wasn't 2006 to 2007.
No.
No.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dempsey. No, this is the change in individual income tax receipts from forecast. It's not the actual level of individual income tax receipts.
Okay. So that and the reason why I asked that question was because of the fact that then you go down on page 4. Mm-hmm. On page 4, you see that we've got growth in employment. And so I'm glad that you clarified that in regard to that situation. Very good. Thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question about the employment statistics. Do you have any correlation there on what kind of income these jobs are creating? What type of jobs are we talking about here? Or is this just plain any job from the lowest paying to the highest paying jobs?
Representative Clark, these are just jobs, and in fact, there's no distinction between part-time jobs and full-time jobs. It comes from what's called the payroll survey, which asks people, employers, how many people they had employed during the week of the 12th, and so there's no distinction there. Now, there are other bits of data that we get on a more delayed basis that talk about wage growth. And what we've seen is that wage growth in Minnesota has not done particularly well over the last year and a half or so. There may be some technical reasons for it, but one of the things that we've questioned is whether the national wage growth was really as good as the data showed, because we didn't think Minnesota was falling behind as much as that. And in the book we say that we think that the national wage growth is going to be revised down, and yesterday the national wage growth was revised down. No, I'm sorry, it was the day before yesterday. The national wage growth for the first quarter was revised down fairly substantially. So wage growth just hasn't been as good as anywhere as we would think, but neither has job growth. Job growth has not been particularly good since the 2001 recession. In that period, it has taken us much longer than on average to get back to the level of employment that existed at the end of the recession. It's took us an extremely long time. If you look at the graph on page 4, at the bottom of page 4, what this graph shows is how long it took us to get back to the level of employment that we had at the start of the recession. You see, the recession started in February of 2001. For the U.S. as a whole, it was almost 4 years later, in December of 2005, that we got back to the level of employment that we had when the recession started. And for Minnesota, it took us another half a year to get back to that level. And then the growth rate after that has been adequate, but it's not been anything spectacular or anything like that. So this has been a very, very slow recovery out of the recession.
Representative Clark, follow up, and then Representative Flinzing.
Thank you. Just one other maybe related question. On the single family housing starts and the permits, mm-hmm. housing.
I haven't gotten to that.
Oh, you haven't gotten there? I'll wait.
Okay. Representative Flinzing.
Thank you. Dr. Stinson, as we, as the baby boomers retire and we have fewer people to fill the jobs, are we going to start to see job growth decline or stagnate anyway? that rate of job growth?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clemson. Yeah, the state demographer and I have been talking about the challenge that's facing not just Minnesota but all states in the next decade in particular as the baby boomers begin to retire. Everybody knows that the baby boomers are going to retire and that it's a big cohort. What is less well known is that the cohort that is entering the workforce, the people that will be 18 to 25, that's a very small cohort. It's not going to come anywhere near replacing the baby boomers that are out. And it's not just a Minnesota phenomenon. It's a national phenomenon. The state demographer and I gave a talk before representatives of all the Big Ten universities, and so instead of our Minnesota graph, we used one for all of the upper Midwest, all the Big Ten states. And the graph looked pretty much the same. You know, the numbers along the axis were different, but the pattern was still the same. And so that's a concern, and it raises a concern for long-term economic policy for the state of Minnesota. And the long-term economic policy that we've got to think about in part for the state of Minnesota is that we've got to worry about how do we keep and attract those 18 to 25-year-old people that are going to be the new entrants into the labor force. How do we get them to Minnesota? I've said maybe a little in jest, but there aren't a lot of people sitting on the beach in California saying, boy, when I get to be 18, I'm moving to Minnesota. And that's what we've got to figure out is how do we get those people to Minnesota in there. That may be something that has to do with tuition policy, out-of-state tuition policy, because it's certainly going to be easier to recruit somebody from the University of Minnesota than elsewhere. It may be something to do with who knows what, but it's something we have to be starting to think about.
Okay, Dr. Stinson.
Turning to the top of page 5, the concern that we and everybody else has is what's going to happen with the housing industry. Nationally, housing starts are expected to drop 22% in 2007, and you can see this from this graph that that's a pretty steep graph, a pretty steep drop. Housing starts were about 1.75 million at the start of 2006. They dropped to 1.41 million. They're going to drop to about 1.25 million in the current forecast, although Global Insight has given us indications that they will be bringing the housing outlook down some more in their December forecast. There were housing numbers that were released today that were pessimistic enough that causes people to be even more concerned about the housing. There are really a couple of issues here. One is there's direct employment, people that build houses. Two, there are people that make things and sell things that are added to the house. Anybody that's bought a house knows that when you buy the house, that's not the end of your spending. You also have to buy window treatments. You have to buy this. You have to buy this. You have to do landscaping, all these kinds of things. So all of those ancillary services are going to be affected as well. You look at the graph on the bottom of page 5, this is not just an East Coast and West Coast and Gulf Coast phenomenon. This is a Minnesota phenomenon as well. If you look at the graph at the bottom of page 5, this shows on a quarterly basis the number of housing permits issued in Minnesota, and it's seasonally adjusted, so reflects the fact that we don't have a lot of housing permits issued in December and January, for example. If you look, you see that we've gone from 2,500 per month in the first quarter of 2006 on a seasonally adjusted basis down to 1,600 per month, and in the fourth quarter we're expecting 1,500 per month. That's a 40% decline in housing activity, housing permits. I've talked to builders groups, and the outlook that builders have is not particularly good. They see the inventory situation as being way out of line and are not going to be building at the same rate as they have in the past. And this actually may be an optimistic forecast. It may well be that we'll stay down around the 1,500 starts or permits per month level pretty much through 2007. It depends on how fast we work through that inventory. So there are those two pieces, and then the graph at the top of page 6 shows the other concern that we have for housing. And that graph on the top of page 6 shows the average sale price for housing, which is a proxy for the average price of housing, existing housing. What you can see in that graph is that there's a seasonal pattern to sales prices. The prices are lower in the winter than they are in the summer. But if you look at the four arrows for 2007, you see that they're all lower than the one four quarters earlier was in 2006. This is really an unprecedented situation in the modern economy. We haven't had a decline in housing prices since the Depression, and this is something that is outside of our model's capability to estimate, really. We're not real comfortable with that. It may be that nothing happens, it doesn't affect anything, but you can build scarier scenarios, and the scarier scenarios include the fact that a lot of consumption has been financed by mortgage equity withdrawals. And if that mortgage equity withdrawal stops, then consumption may go back down. And the other possibility is that there's a wealth component to consumption as well. People that are richer, that have a greater net worth, even though with the same income as someone else, tend to consume more. And housing equity is the largest component of most people's net worth. And so there's a concern that there would be a drop-off in consumption as well. So those are the concerns that we have looking out toward the economy, that housing effect on consumption. Now, there are other things that we can worry about as well, the value of the dollar, oil prices, inflation, interest rates, all of those. But the number one thing at this point to worry about, I think, and to watch is what's going on with housing.
Madam Chair?
I have a couple questions here. I'll start with Mary Liz Holden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stinson, this whole housing thing is a huge thing in the area that I represent, and I've had a number of meetings with people in the industry, and what they're telling me is that lots are ready to go, so the street, the curb, the gutter, everything's in. At an 05 rate of sales, there's somewhere between a 3 and 4 year supply of lots sitting ready to go. At an 06 rate of sale, in excess of a 5 year supply of lots all ready to go. So the guys that are driving the big earth movers and putting in the subdivisions, the big utility workers, there's virtually no work next year for them. You said that this was outside of your model's capability to predict the reduction in the cost of housing.
Oh, yes, yes.
Right. How did you come with your guesstimate of the 8,000 jobs directly related to the industry and the approximately 2,000 more in the ancillary areas, which may have been presented in your presentation the other day? And then have you looked at the ramifications to communities as well, local units of government, the figures from just one builder in Minnesota for the payments that they made to local units of government from August 05 to July of 06, and just one builder did almost $18 million in permits and payments to local units of government and to counties and state agencies almost $500,000. That's just one builder. What's the ramifications for our units of government for this as well?
Dr. Stinson?
Okay. There are several questions. Let me see if I can answer them in some kind of order. Your description of the situation with respect to lots is absolutely on target. There's a service for builders called Market Graphics that inventories lots and building activity in the Twin Cities, the extended Twin Cities metropolitan area, not just the seven county area, but beyond that. Last January, one of the ways that you can present that, they have across the top of the page different housing price ranges, and down the side of it they have different jurisdictions. One of the ways that you can present that is by looking at the inventory situation compared to what's considered to be normal, and the way it's been presented is that the color is square in dark green if it's good, you color it in light green if it's still pretty good but not quite as good as good. Yellow and orange are kind of cautionary. Light red is not very good, and red is not good at all. Okay. And if I showed you the picture from last January and you looked at it, you'd say I was showing you a green piece of paper with a few yellow and orange dots on it. If I showed you the picture from October, you'd say you were looking at a red piece of paper with a couple of yellow and orange dots on it. The inventory situation has changed that rapidly. So you're absolutely right about that. Okay. The housing price issue is not what has been driving our forecast with respect to construction employment and with respect to lumber and wood products employment. What drives our forecast with respect to those things is this housing permit forecast that we have there. And so that's how we're getting the 8,000 construction industry jobs lost in there, is by looking at what's happened to housing permits thus far and what's likely to happen to them going off into the future. That's the way we get the 8,000. It doesn't have anything to do with the housing price issue. The housing price issue is one that's going to affect consumption overall, would affect demand for manufactured goods, retail trade, things like that. Okay, the third question is what about the proffers, really, I suppose you might call them, the payments that builders make for development in communities, and won't this create a problem? And the answer is certainly that will go down. It's not going to affect all communities because the places that the inventories that are going to last the longest are going to be the third ring suburbs. That's the place where the housing market's going to collapse the most. Now, in part, what that means is that they're not going to have to add the water and sewer and roads and curbs and gutters and all those kinds of things in there off into the future. That, you know, they've in theory paid for a lot of that already, but they are going to have a lot of infrastructure sitting there that isn't going to be used for several years. You're absolutely right.
Representative Holberg. And if I might then follow up the figures of the 8,000 and the 2,000, another issue that we're seeing a lot is that representing a community that enjoyed rapid escalation of valuation, and many homeowners bought with very little down, with the hopes of capitalizing on the trend of rapid escalation in the price of the property and gaining equity that way, if you will. And then in some instances, taking out the home equity loans, like you stated, to buy whatever, boats, whatever. Now what we're seeing is that because actually in Dakota County I've been told that we have seen a 4% depression in the valuation of property already, and they expect that that will continue. Where do you account for the loss of those kinds of jobs, the jobs relative to the lower consumption, less money in the market? I understand the 8 was directly related to the building. The 2 was like the lumber products. Where do you account for what I view to be a pretty large residual reduction in spending?
Okay. Dr. Simpson?
Madam Chairman and Representative Holtman, you remember I said that we don't have the same kind of growth overall in the rest of the economy as we had this year, for example. This year, up to this point, 54,000 jobs. Next year, we're saying 21,000 jobs. Okay. Some of the slowdown from this year's job increases is due to this weaker wealth effect coming in through there. And it's, it's a serious issue. And the question that we have, and the part that we really don't know from our models, is how serious it's going to be. It could be more serious than this or not. We just haven't seen a situation where housing prices have gone down, and so we don't know what's going to happen. Now, we've done the best that we can do, but we could be wrong. We could be too pessimistic, or we could be too optimistic, and it's just hard to know at this point.
And okay, just one brief follow-up. Given cycles of building, is it how much will you see by February, or do you expect that it'll likely be until next November before you see what the real impacts of this are?
Madam Chair, Representative Holford, the Christmas sales are going to be a key indicator as to what's going on. That'll help us. That'll give us some information, because we'll see how people are reacting to this adverse news. Now, we aren't going to know how long it takes for it to bottom out or anything like that, but we will have some additional information. And so Christmas sales and Christmas sales tax receipts are always an important part of the February forecast, but this time they're going to be even more important.
All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Krenke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stinson, could you just give us an indication as to when you say, obviously, we haven't seen a decline in existing home prices since the end of or the middle 50s, but...
No, since the Depression.
I'm sorry. Okay, a few years back. So you said it's not a... What indicators do you have in your model that might help people determine what the trend line might be? I mean, default rates, number of reverse mortgage, any of that information in the model?
Dr. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative Krenke. We have housing prices in the model. It's just that we've always had gains in housing prices, and so you're always thinking that they're going to be going up or flat. You don't know what happens, whether it's a cement. The issue really is the change symmetric? If you have a 1% increase in housing prices, do you get the same reaction as if you have a 1% decrease in housing prices? You can say, well, yeah, they should be about the same, but you can also say, no, people are going to shrug off a 1% decline in housing prices because they're not going to sell their house anyway, or people are going to panic go on in more, so that's the issue really there, is whether there's a symmetry in response.
Representative,
sure. But Dr. Sisson, I guess, what indicators are you, you mentioned Christmas sales, but other indicators, as I said, the
default rates? I mean, obviously you watch those, do you not? I mean,
Madam Chair, Representative Crickson, we look at the default rates, and those affect our judgments that we make, but they're not part of the specifically part of the model. Again, we're going to be in a situation potentially where default rates are way outside the range of any thing that we've estimated as well, and so this is just a new situation for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Thank you. Actually, that last question was one I was kind of wondering about, because I know in my own city, the issue of foreclosure is huge, and we used to have a pretty good family homeless prevention. Foreclosure prevention program at the state, it's been kind of gutted. Maybe we have to get it back online again. But I'm just wondering, can you help us anticipate any of that? Is who besides maybe the housing agency is helping us look at that?
Dr. Simpson?
I didn't quite understand what you said right at the end.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering if we can look to you for any help in projecting some of what we might need to do to deal with that issue. The foreclosure issue,
That's not really, Madam Chair, Representative Clark, that's not really my group's responsibility. There is a housing finance agency within the state that I think is more informed on those specific topics than we are. You know, we'd be more than happy to consult with them or to talk with you, but that's not an area that we have a great deal of specialized information on.
And
Representative Clark.
One of the reasons that might be helpful, I think, is if we're using the issue of housing prices to look at our forecast. With more and more foreclosures, I would guess some of those prices will change too. And so it seems like if there would be a way to kind of track the two together, that might be useful.
Dr. Simpson.
Madam Chair, you know, we're very concerned about the spin out of the foreclosure issue. The potential for this spinning out of control, I don't want to overstate it or anything like that, but once you have foreclosures and lower prices, you have people walking away basically from loans. Suddenly the paper that was issued for those loans becomes less good, and so drives up or drives down the quality of the credit and drives up interest rates, and you know, that spins out into the global economy now, because people outside the U.S. are also holding U.S. mortgages as well, and so you know, this has potential larger than city of Minneapolis ramifications.
I'm aware. I'm just starting at home and actually joining a question. I think Representative Crinkey's suggesting, you know, maybe I'd like to know what's happening out in your neck of the woods too. You know, maybe it's similar. We can find some common cause to work on this together.
Dr. Simpson, members, we have a number of a few more people to ask questions, but I do have a question before we move along. Given this kind of a gloomy conversation we're having about housing starts, et cetera, but this is one of the largest budget surpluses for our state government that I've seen since I've been at the legislature in the last 4 years. So how did it seems kind of incongruous. Can you explain, you know, why things are so bad in one category, but we're really kind of looking at one of the better surpluses we've seen in a long time?
Madam Chair, first of all, the housing sector, while it's an important sector, is a small sector. It's a small part of the economy. It's only about 6% of the economy. So a 16% decline in the housing sector, which is what's being projected more or less, only reduces GDP growth by 1%. Now, it doesn't bring the economy down. It reduces it from its trend level of 3 or 3.5% by 1%. So it brings GDP growth down to 2 or 2.5% by itself. And so that's that's kind of the broad macroeconomic implication of this. The reason why we have the budget, the large budget surplus, the $2 billion budget surplus, is first of all, we started with $700 million of budget surplus. If the forecasts were exactly perfect and the expenditures were exactly perfect and on forecast, you would have had $700 million. So we're only adding $1.4 billion. We already have in the bank a substantial amount from fiscal 06, and through fiscal 06 this housing problem hadn't really come to rest yet. And so the amount that we're adding, while it looks like a lot, and to quote Commissioner Ingeson, I wouldn't want to say that $1 billion isn't a lot or anything like that. It's not a huge growth here that we have.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for putting that into the bigger picture. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Stinson, perhaps piggybacking a little bit on that, but in a little different course. It was, I think, anticipated that we'd see, because cycles happen. We've had such a remarkably strong housing market for a long time, really. But this feels different, really, and it seems a little incongruent. Not only, you know, forget about the surplus, but if you look at where we are in overall jobs growth, in terms of income, inflation rates seem to be not too bad. Even the interest rates in housing are not really too bad. It's hard then to figure out what's really driving this. I mean, there may have been some overspeculation. Some builders tell me that's certainly part of it, but that happens. I mean, that's kind of a normal cycle. And yet, from everything you said, this sounds a little beyond the normal cycle. It's pretty hard to understand it if we don't sort of aren't we able to relate to sort of a cause effect. What are the root causes, if you have any ideas yourself or even speculation about sort of why is it that it seems so different? Why is it that we're sitting in the middle of what sounds like some pretty dark news? And even if it's a small percentage overall, it has, I think, as Representative Holberg talks about, I think the longer term of this could be pretty substantial impact in a lot of places. So cause, effect, root causes, any ideas?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley. To look at the root causes and effects, you need to go back a few years to the extremely low interest rates that we had in 93, 94, 95, in there. And that stimulated demand for housing. The top part of the housing cycle was very strong for a much longer period than anybody had suspected it would be, and much longer than it would be historically. And so what happened, because of the low interest rates, we had overbuilding. We borrowed from the future, people that wouldn't normally have been able to afford to buy a house with a lower interest for another couple of years were able to buy a house more quickly in there. And so I think that is what set the process in motion. And then when interest rates started to go up and begin to bite, suddenly, as is typical with higher interest rates, you push off, you delay decisions to purchase housing once the interest rates get up at a certain level. And so you had both the borrowing from the future that had was causing less demand out into the future, and suddenly the higher interest rates causing less demand as well. The other thing I think that's happened, and at least that we're hypothesizing that's happened, is that builders had better information, and instead of keeping going and ratcheting back just a few units each month or something like that, they said, wait a minute, the inventory situation is out of control. I'm not going to go there. I'm out for a while. And so we've seen just this really rapid drop-off. If you look at the bottom of page 5, again, 2,500 permits a month down to 1,600, 1,500 a month. And that, I think, is kind of a combination of what's going on. Now, in our forecast, we're recognizing the fact that this has been a little steeper drop than has occurred in the past, and we're saying that we think it's pretty much largely done, that people are going to hit a base level and then go from there for a while. But we could be wrong. It could turn around and go back up more quickly. But the demographics don't look to me like they're going to push things up more quickly here. They could also go down a little bit more than, or a little bit longer than we have, and I think that's the risk to the forecast.
Thank you.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Dr. Simpson, I've got a couple questions that maybe I missed it. The first one I'd have is, how is this chart at the top of page 6 calculated, existing housing prices? Is this just the average of what houses sold at, or what is it?
Dr. Simpson.
Madam Chair, Representative Knobloch, this is the median, not the average, and so if you're worried about fewer $10 million houses somehow affecting it, it's not that it's the median, it's the house that 50% minus one of the houses sold higher and 50% minus one of the houses sold lower. So, and that's the accepted number, because the average of it all we don't know.
Okay, Madam Chair, the reason I ask is that, I mean, houses are different than most other products, and that, I mean, if you buy Ford Taurus and Albert Lee, Minneapolis, or International Falls, you're still buying the same Ford Taurus, whereas, I mean, every house is different to some extent. And, I mean, I guess, have you looked at, is there anything going on in the mix in that maybe higher-priced houses are just selling less now, or lower-priced houses are just selling less or more? Is there anything like that that's going on?
Dr. Simpson?
Madam Chair, Representative Knobloch, that's a good question, and the answer is there's weakness all across the board. And again, back to this piece that I was describing, the red piece of paper versus the green piece of paper, was across all price levels and all areas in the Twin Cities metro area.
Madam Chair, Dr. Stinson, if you look at the graphs on page 5 on housing starts, do you have any idea how that compares to 1981, which in my view was probably the worst housing market we had between certainly now and the Great Depression? I guess I'm surprised that housing prices actually didn't drop back then, because, I mean, mortgage rates were at 17.5%, and I remember it well because the first real management job I had was running a real estate brokerage company in 1981, and it wasn't a pleasant experience.
Dr. Simpson?
It looks like we had 1.1 million houses. 1977, we were at 1.96 million. 1977, we were at 2 million. 1978, we're at 1.7 million. Representative Knobloch entered the job market and housing area. We're at 1.3 million. 1.1 million the next year. 1.05 million. In 82, then 1.7 million. Now, were you still in the job market, or in the housing market?
Yeah, I was still there. I was working hard to turn it around.
Okay. Well, 1.7 million. So, one, two, three, there were 3 years where the bottom just really and truly fell out in there.
I'm just curious. I mean, it sounds like it dropped almost 50% at one point there. So, I mean, here it's 37%. I guess hopefully it doesn't go any lower than 37%. Apparently, prices did not drop back then, median prices, according to your statement, but apparently they did here. So I don't know where that leaves us, but I also am very concerned about the housing market. And I whenever I see that Ugg Buys Ugly Houses guy billboard that you see all over, remember the company that I was managing back then had bought all these homes to help make deals happen, and then they were stuck with all these homes that it took years to sell. And there's got to be a lot of that out there that's a drag on the market. Thanks. No more questions.
Well, that was a good question. My parents, I remember, in 81 bought a brand new house at 13% interest rates. So things were not good in the early 80s for buying houses here in Minnesota. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hector Simpson. Housing prices falling would seem to me that the estimated market values of homes would also be reduced, which would mean lower property taxes, which would be relief to the homeowners, and less money to cities, school districts, counties. Are we yet seeing any of this, or is that a lagging situation, or we will never see it, where the assessor will begin to recognize what's happening in the market?
Dr. Simpson.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, we are not seeing that at this point simply because there's a lag in the translation of housing value to assessment to local tax revenues. That certainly could happen, but our experience during the farm crisis of the 1980s was that huge declines in farm land values still, we're talking about 40-50% declines in farm land values. That still didn't, it took a while before that filtered through, that the market value or the assessed value hadn't caught up with the rapid increases. What we'd expect is that if this lower house price situation goes away after a year or so, that what you'd see is you'd see a pause or a flattening out in property values for property tax purposes, and maybe a little bit of weakness, but not any real noticeable weakness at the local level. Now, of course, it's going to be different in different places. Specific places could be different, but overall, that would be what we would expect. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Carlson has a question.
Yes, I was fortunate to be at the briefing the other day, and we talked about the housing issue, but I did have a question we weren't able to get to, and it's somewhat related. Construction industry generally, commercial, industrial, what's happening in the other sectors of construction?
Dr. Simpson.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, there are two other sectors or two other pieces of the construction industry. There is the commercial, industrial, business property sector. That's expected to be weaker as well. But then there's also the large equipment, road and bridge building and things like that. That's supposed to hold up and actually improve just slightly. One of the problems, though, is that the jobs in the residential housing that are lost, those people aren't necessarily immediately transferable into driving a road grader or a belly dump truck or something like that.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that. I was just interested in whether they were also depressed or not. So, thank you.
Representative Dorman, do you still have a question?
Mr. Chair, I do. I'm curious. It's probably not on the housing area. Do we go to this document next, or what's the...
We're going to, once we're done with this housing slide, we're going to go back to the rest of the document starting on the bottom of page 6. And I guess I'd say let's confine our questions to the housing, and then we'll move on.
I'm going to hold off then.
Okay. Were there any other questions on the housing slide? All right. Dr. Stinson, let's proceed.
Okay, well, the housing news wasn't particularly good, but there's another piece of news that's not particularly good either when you're thinking about state revenues, and that's what's happening to corporate profits and the risk that it's bringing on to us.
if you look at the slide at the bottom of page 6, this is a long history of the relationship between corporate profits and the stock market. And if you look, you can see back in 1960 they were roughly at the same level, and then there's a little bit of variation that goes on until about 1997. And then beginning in 1997, the value of the stock market, the S&P 500, goes up a lot compared to the value of corporate profits. And in 2000, you can see that there's a huge divergence between the very light line and the very dark line there. And those of you that had any money in the stock market in 2000 know that that was kind of the peak of the stock market, and that irrational exuberance went away, and went away pretty quickly, and that suddenly plunged back down. And you can see that by 2002, 2003, we're back on with the same relationship as we've had. More recently, what you see is you see that corporate profits have spiked upward, and the stock market has stayed at roughly the same level as it has before, and growing, you know, at a reasonable rate. There are two ways of interpreting this. One is that now is a really good time to buy the stock market because the stock market's going to track corporate profits up. The other is that those corporate profits may not be as permanent as one might hope. And we're concerned about that simply because we're adding so much money to the forecast because of corporate profits increase. At the top of page 7, you can see that corporate profits as a percentage of GDP are near the post-war high. There's actually one quarter in 1950, in the Korean War, start of the Korean War, when corporate profits as a percentage of GDP were any higher. Otherwise, we're at the highest level we've been in the post-war period. The Congressional Budget Office looked at this and were concerned, and they're bringing their forecast back down to a level of 10% from the level of 13.75% that it's at right now by 2010. Global Insight didn't bring their forecast down near that much. They were still above 11.5% in 2010. We thought it was prudent to take a little bit of that extra money out, and so we followed the Congressional Budget Office's forecast in this area rather than the Global Insight forecast. With that, if there aren't any other questions, we should turn it over to Jim. Or
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and members, I think we're just going to maybe return a little bit to the chart on the bottom of page 2. Jim Showalter will talk a little bit about the changes in spending. And we had also been asked to provide a little bit of information about some of the other funds. Just so you all know, the forecast is the general fund, but we've been asked about some of the balances in the other funds. The highway funds, the healthcare access funds, some of those. So Jim will talk about the spending changes in the forecast as well as some other funds.
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. As the chart shows, you saw this earlier in the presentation, but most of the changes that you see in this forecast really are revenue related. There are some small spending changes that I'll detail presently, but as you see in the bar chart, basically it's the sort of middle tone, that last part of the chart in both 06, 07, and 08, 09 that are represented as changes in this forecast. For the current biennium, that changes about $125 million. That's about 0.4% of total state spending. In 2008 and 09, the budget period that we're going into, the projected change was about $97 million, or about 0.3% In both cases, the changes are somewhat similar in nature, and if you'd like more information, we can certainly talk about those more. For the current biennium, about $60 million in health and human services, about $19 million in K-12, and about $12 million in bond sales are some of the major areas where you see a little bit of lower spending than previously anticipated. I should note that when we're looking at the current biennium, we're particularly now looking at not just the appropriated level, but what we anticipate spending. So at all points in time, the appropriation level is, you know, largely, you know, sort of the top level, particularly for discretionary grants and things like that. It's only selected programs like medical assistance or some of the K-12 enrollment things that you might see some upside to them. In 8 and 9, the changes are largely, again, in some of those same areas, along with debt service. Debt service is slightly lower, about $56 million, primarily because the interest rates are a little bit lower than anticipated, and when that happens, you offer, essentially get a premium on the front end of offering any bond sales. In human services, spending is about $63 million lower. That's mostly due to slightly lower caseload, particularly in long-term care. Slightly higher spending in education. In this instance, slightly higher enrollment than previously estimated.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clearly what we've heard here is we should have had a bigger bonding bill, apparently, and what I want everyone to know is, had we had one, your project would have been the one that was included. So, but having said that, you know, as we look at these numbers, and I got a couple questions about what the legislature will deal with in 07 and in the years out. If you add that pesky inflation in there, what do those numbers look like? If I follow the charts together, you know, and I just wonder, 07, what kind of one-time money will the legislature have to spend? And if you add inflation in there, what will it look like at the end of the next biennium? And I'm curious, you know, you talked about Global Insight. What would they recommend for an inflation rate? I see buried in this report is, I think, CPI, but then I'm not sure if that's what they'd have used. And so I'm just curious what the surplus would look like after inflation.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dorman, I'll jump to the chart on the last chart on the bottom of page 7 to talk about this a little bit. Oopsie. And basically what you'll see is that this is a picture when we talk about structural and we're trying to take out those carry forward balances and reserves and just look at the revenue coming in each period and the spending going out each period. And so this looks at 2008, 2009, and 10 and 11. Now, this is the first time we've had planning estimates for 2010 and 11. This is what we would use, the 10 and 11 planning estimates, to when we're evaluating the effects of the budget proposals on 08, 09, what their effect is on 10 and 11. But at this point, when we've got kind of 4 years sitting here looking at us, you know, that compounded inflation effect, is showing there on that line. You see the difference between revenues and spending being positive, but what we're showing here in this document and on this chart is the estimated effect of inflation on spending using the CPI, and as you can see, it's roughly in balance for the 08-09 year. So we would basically not be describing a very significant surplus in 2008-2009 if we were including the effects of inflation. So in this way of trying to manage some of the expectations when people talk about a $2 billion surplus, if we were to look at 2008-2009 and say we're roughly going to keep all programs at the current level and inflate them, the expected inflation rate, we wouldn't really have a lot of money.
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Is that a realistic expected inflation rate? Is CPI really, really accurate, or what would the, you know, our partners have suggested that we use, same people that look at our, help us through the projecting revenues, would they recommend CPI, or is there another indicator that they look at?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair and Representative Dorman, we have a Council of Economic Advisors And we had some discussion about this in the larger document. Our Council of Economic Advisors had a discussion about this. I'm not sure, Representative Knobloch, if you were at the meeting when we had the discussion on inflation, but some members of the council raised the question and said that they thought that the state not being like a typical consumer, the CPI is probably not as relevant a measure and not as meaningful as something like the price deflator for state and local, and that's known as the PGSL rate. It's roughly about 0.5% higher each year than the numbers we're using on the CPI, and the Council of Economic Advisors actually recommended that we use the PGSL rate, and we include actually in the summary document you'll see on page 8 the effects of what that would show, the numbers what that would be compounded throughout the period. But I'll say, Mr. Chair and Representative Dorman, what we didn't want to make a change just because of the fact that inflation has been a little bit sensitive, so we're showing in our documents the what the council has recommended. And furthermore, we had some discussion internally about whether to just shift to using that other rate, and decided that because of the fact that there are some areas of our budget where we have included inflation, particularly in a couple of areas in the Health and Human Services area, where we make projections about both caseload and some of the costs of care, if we were purchasing in the marketplace some of the managed care costs, they have inflation built into the assumptions in the forecast. So we thought that it was probably our right to continue to use the CPI, partly because we didn't want to make a change without having some broader discussion about this, but also we have included in our documents what the effects would be if we were to use what the council recommended. And maybe just one more thing, Mr. Chair and Representative Dorman, is that when you ask the question, what is a reasonable expectation, we have consistently spent in the state budget higher than the rate of inflation, higher than either rates of inflation. So there are other kinds of things happening with state spending other than just simply inflating. There are new services, new programs, changes, new people coming into programs. So our overall rate of growth has exceeded inflation pretty consistently.
Representative Dorman.
Let me see if I got this right. Would it be fair then to say that the next budget that's adopted, if CPI is added to it, and the February forecast holds the same numbers as this one, and you add CPI to the existing budget, you would be able to increase spending $28 million in addition to that after inflation. So in terms of how much could you increase the budget? It'd be $28 million, and if you use the number suggested by the Council of Economic Advisors, aren't we going to be at a deficit situation? Wouldn't that be a deficit situation for any new spending? And so, if you are going to increase spending beyond that, wouldn't you have to increase revenue somewhere to stay in balance? Or?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair and Representative Dorman, that'd be right. And I think that the important thing that we note here is the difference between a forecast, where we're just kind of generally trying to take a look at what the pressure is between revenue and spending, versus actually when we start the budget process, we'll be talking about a starting point that is the current level of spending and making decisions about where to spend more. But if we were, as you suggest, just simply to look at these as and inflate things the way we expected in order to assure the same level of services, there would be little money left, or even less if we looked at a higher rate.
Representative Dorman.
Well, I think it would be helpful to look at those spending costs similar to how we project the increase in revenues. I mean, the only reason you see that the surplus at all is the fact that we talk about inflation and revenues and just pretend it doesn't exist for the most part in spending, and that's not realistic. So I'm concerned that we're setting up an awful lot of unrealistic expectations when people think there's a $2 billion budget surplus, and I think we've got a projected deficit. But I understand maybe for one reason or another why people might want to present that differently, and okay. What does it mean in one-time money for the 07 legislature? What do they have to, you know, in my district, you know, we didn't pass a school referendum, and I keep telling people, don't worry about a darn thing, because elected a good Democrat now, and I got 84 folks over on the other side of the aisle, and I expect they won't have to pass an excess levy next year, because I heard all the campaign promises, so I think that I'm really anticipating good things for our school district. How much one-time money will the 07 legislature be able to spend?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dorman, the way we generally look at this, and this is actually an oversimplification, because when we think about
that's good for me. I'm kind of a
well, but when we think about the structural thing, you really have to look at the growth in revenue and spending in various areas, and there's some healthy growth in the revenues. And I maybe just take for a minute you to the strike document, the last page 11 there. And that shows what's kind of going on in terms of what we mostly have talked to you about here today is the changes in the forecast. And that's just our last reference point was the end of the legislative session. This is a chart that shows you what's going on between the current biennium and the next in terms of growth. And you'll see that there's the current resources on tax revenues. There's 5% growth in tax revenues. Biennium over biennium. But then you look down below and Health and Human Services, which is a sizable portion of the budget, has 13.5% growth projected in spending. So this whole sustainable budget into the future question has to be looking at what kind of, how you're spending the money. Are you spending it in areas that are, you know, creating lots more obligations in the future? There's a lot of growth. But generally, when we think about what we've got is this $2 billion. We would describe to people that we've got the surplus from the 06-07 biennium at slightly over $1 billion. And then you've got the budget in 08-09 relatively balanced if you account for inflation. So you, what you would be wanting to do is to make sure that that surplus in 06-07 wasn't spent necessarily on growing ongoing programs in 08-09. You wouldn't have room. So if that's the way you're thinking about it, then a simple way to say it is you got, of the surplus of $2 billion, $1 billion is available for one time, and the other $1 billion is needed to keep existing programs at the same level.
Representative Dorman, Earhart, and Krinke. Representative Dorman.
So it would be fair to say then the 07 legislature could spend in some combination either tax rebates, property tax relief for K-12 education, nursing homes, on a one-time basis, just over $1 billion after taking into account inflation, particularly if they use maybe what I would consider a more realistic number, you got a problem by the end of the next biennium, no matter what you do with that one-time money, you've got that problem. So it's going to be interesting. So I'm sort of sorry I'm not going to be here to see it now. I'll have to watch it on Channel 17.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got two questions. One just by the last page. It looks to me like the largest or the largest growing segment of our budget is debt service. And that has to do with bonding, Representative Norman.
But it's not as much as we thought. We should have had a bigger bill. We just sent it all to Edina.
Okay. Well, I think I'm looking at that correctly. Am I correct there? Yes. The other question I have is MVEST transfer, in, as they come about, even though they're going to be reduced because of the MVEST, are they included in these figures?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Dorman, no.
Earhart.
Representative Earhart, the what's shown on these pages is you'll see the loss in MVEST in the general fund, because this is just the general fund on the revenue
right.
side. But actually, we do have some information, and Jim Showalter can talk a little bit about kind of the status of the highway funds, because in fact, even though there is the dedication of the MVEST, it's a declining source of revenue, and in addition, the current MVEST going statutorily into the highway funds and the transportation funds is declining. So you've got another place where there might be a mismatch in expectations if people think there's a lot more money because of the constitutional dedication.
Right.
In fact, it's somewhat filling a hole that may exist. And Jim can talk a little bit maybe about the changes in the highway fund balances.
Is that counting as spending because we're reducing the general fund?
No, on this page.
As it was page 7, the structural balance.
No, the on that page, Representative Earhart, the revenues would be showing a lower amount due to the MVEST in 2008-2009, about $150 million, and I'm not sure the amount is
0809. Right. Right.
Lower revenues.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Representative Prinke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, since we were talking about inflation, what was, can you tell us what the percentage of general fund increase last biennial 405 to 06-07 is?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prinke, I kind of had this feeling when I made that last comment about our growth that someone might ask me that question. I'm sorry, I don't think that I have that here right now.
Well, Ms. Anderson, I got it yesterday from Mr. Marks. It's 12.4%. So can you tell me what the CPI is during that same period of time?
Commissioner.
3.4.
Just a second.
Oh, wait.
Dr. Stinson is looking up the figure.
Well,
while he's doing that, Representative Prinke.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, my point is I don't think we need to worry about including inflation in these numbers in the context that the legislature always seems to well exceed whatever the CPI is. My guess is that the legislature implicit price deflator and all those other numbers that we like to talk about. The propensity to spend here is far greater than the CPI or virtually any other index. So I don't think you need to worry about building it in because generally we tend to ignore those numbers anyway and spend whatever we want to spend, whether we have it in the budget or not. So the other thing, to that point, Dr. Stinson, I remember some of those conversations. You probably had some of them with former Representative Bishop as well, talking about what is almost a built-in escalator in the tax system, both property tax, income tax, sales tax. Can you give us a little insight into what the automatic inflator in the tax code is? I mean, obviously, as consumer prices go up, sales tax goes up. As wages go up, even though income taxes are indexed, they aren't totally indexed. What's the multiplier? We talk about the CPI. What's the multiplier on the tax side of the equation?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Prinke, it's about 1. If you get a 1% increase in the CPI in prices, you get about 1% more in sales tax. If you get a 1% increase in wages, you get about 1% increase. Now, it's a little different because there's an indexing that goes on that keeps you from being pushed into a higher tax bracket and things like that, but it's really just about 1.
Did we find out what the CPI was over the last...
It's about 6.3.
So,
I'm sorry, 6.3% over the biennium?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Prinke.
So we
doubled it?
Yeah. So, I think, as I said, I don't think we need to worry about too much about building inflation into the budget forecast. The legislature will take care of that for itself.
Representative Beard, did you have a question?
Yes, I've got
All right. Okay. Back to Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, I'd just say a couple more comments on the spending side of the equation. As the commissioner mentioned, there was growth biennium to biennium, and much of that information is similar to what you saw at the end of session. Debt service increases substantially, as well as health and human services. Otherwise, the rest of the budget is largely the same, some increases in education and some other areas that's pretty much offset by some one-time spending, primarily the buying back of the education payment shifts. Two last things that I wanted to leave you with. One is that you might be interested in the debt capacity going forward, that that's tied to the revenue streams that are going there, that changes in this forecast. Given this current revenue forecast, our estimates of the maximum amount is 975 in the even-numbered session. That would be next year. This current session, the session that's coming up right now, is typically not a bonding year. That number would be $135 million. Lastly, we were understood that there were some questions about other funds and what was happening in some of those other funds. We're preparing a document that will be ready next week that will detail some of the major direct appropriated funds, and we'll be happy to distribute that to the committee if that would be acceptable to the committee. Just a couple of highlights to that. At this point, we are finalizing that, but you should know about a couple of key things. Included in that is the Healthcare Access Fund. There's not a lot of change in the current biennium or the next change, but it's all positive. And by and large, we're looking at about $188 million balance by the end of 2009. That would continue to grow going into 2011. In the Trunk Highway Fund, as was previously alluded to, you would expect with the dedication of NVEST that that fund would start to look more healthy, particularly in the next couple of years. However, due to the declines in the MVEST revenue stream itself, as well as some declines in the gas tax, those pretty much counterbalance each other, at least in the next couple of years. The balance by the end of 2009, even with the dedication being accounted for, is about $114 million. So we will give you a lot more detail, a lot more background, and hopefully in a little bit more user-friendly manner than our consolidated fund statements, and that will be ready for you shortly, and also be on our website once that's completed.
One last policy-related question I've got. Going back to the corporate profits and what you had talked about with Hutchinson Technology, and Hutchinson Technology having a significantly smaller hit to the state budget than we had expected, what exactly is that from? Is any of that related to the legislation we passed a few years ago, which did close some of the FOC so-called loopholes or credits, exemptions, however you want to term them, or what was the reason for that big difference?
Mr. Chairman, part of it may have been, we just take the Department of Revenue's estimate, and if they change their estimate, we take the change in the estimate. We don't know the reasons for the change in the estimate. But for the of the $220 million, $73 million was due to lower than expected refunds, and $59 million was due to lower than expected interest. And so the refund issue shouldn't have been affected by legislative action because that's prior law or anything like that. If you look into foregone prospective revenue, that changed by $52 million or $53 million. So that conceivable part of that would have been there, but certainly not anything more than that $52 million that was there.
That's really a question we should, or someone should ask the Department of Revenue.
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions for the Commissioner or Dr. Stinson? All right, members, is there any other, I've got a few comments I'd like to make, but is there any other business to come before the committee? I'm going to ask my DFL colleagues if you have any bills, amendments you'd like to bring forward at this time that our side could just vote down sort of for old time's sake.
We'll take our opportunity in January 3rd.
All right. Well, members, just a couple things then. First, we do have per diem forms that Shirley Kotterick, our very capable legislative assistant and committee legislative assistant, is handing out. I'll go ahead and be happy to sign those now or just get them to her office, and we'll take care of that paperwork. I do want to thank our staff for all the great work they've done. Shirley, absolutely, for the cookies and everything else she has done for us these last 2 years. Margaret, now Martin, to my right, our researcher who has been very capable, Kathy Novak, and, of course, Bill Marks, who has always kept us so informed and had all the answers to all the questions, and for those few he didn't, know where to get the answers. I want to thank all of you for the opportunity to serve with you, since this is the last meeting that I anticipate chairing. I also want to thank all of you for your service, in that some of you have been on this committee for 4 years, and we started out with a $4.5 billion deficit to contend with in this committee 4 years ago. We go into the next session with a $2.2 billion surplus. Even if you were only on this committee for the last 2 years, we had a significant deficit when we started this committee. We have a significant surplus now, and it is to all of your credit that we have helped turn that around for our state of Minnesota. With that, I appreciate the service I've had with you, appreciate all your friendship, and look forward to staying in touch. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Meeting adjourned.